You ever look at something that everybody else has written off and think, no, that one's coming home? I'm Taildragger, and this is the hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair, because this one took almost 2 decades of stubbornness, a small army of volunteers, and more donated weekends than anybody can count. I want to tell you about a B-29 superfortress named Doc. Now, most folks know there are only 2 flying B-29s left in the world. Fifi gets all the headlines. She's been flying with the Commemorative Air Force since the 70s. But Doc is the one that shouldn't exist at all. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. So let's go back, way back. Doc rolled off the Boeing assembly line in Wichita, Kansas in 1944. She was Boeing serial number 446175, a B-29-45BW, and like thousands of her sisters, she was built for one purpose, end the war in the Pacific. But here's the thing, Doc never saw combat. The war ended before she shipped out. So the Army Air Forces did what they did with a lot of surplus airplanes. They put her to work in other ways. Doc spent time doing radar calibration and various military tasks, and eventually she ended up at Naval Weapons Center China Lake out in the California desert. China Lake, if you've never been out there, picture the driest, most barren stretch of the Mojave you can imagine. Sand, rocks, Joshua trees, and heat that'll melt the soles off your boots. The Navy used B-29s out there as targets, weapons testing. They'd park the old bombers on the range, point missiles and rockets at them, and see what happened. One by one, those big silver birds got torn apart by ordnance, riddled with shrapnel, left to bake in the sun. Doc sat out there for decades, just sitting on that hard pan, getting sandblasted by wind, bleached by ultraviolet, slowly surrendering to the desert. Most people who saw her figured she was scrap, a hulk, a piece of history too far gone to save. Now, here's where it gets interesting. In 1987, a man named Tony Mazzolini was flying over China Lake and spotted several B-29s on the range. Tony was an aviation enthusiast with a dream that most people would call crazy. He wanted to find a B-29 and restore her to flying condition, not static display, not a museum piece, flying. He looked at what was sitting out there in the desert and decided that one particular airplane, the one that would become Doc, was the best candidate. She'd been spared the worst of the weapons testing. She still had her basic structure. She was rough, no question about it, missing engines, missing props, missing most of her interior, corrosion everywhere, but the bones were there. Tony started working the bureaucracy to get permission to recover her, and if you think restoring a bomber is hard, try getting a surplus military aircraft released from an active weapons range. It took years of paperwork, negotiations, and flat-out pleading. But in 1998, 11 years after he first spotted her, Doc was finally trucked off the range and moved to a hangar in Wichita. Why Wichita? Because that's where she was born. Boeing had built her there during the war, and Wichita still had people who remembered how to work on a B-29. Some of the volunteers who showed up to help had actually built B-29s during World War II. Let that sink in. The same hands that riveted her together in 1944 came back to put her together again. The restoration was massive. And I don't mean weekend project massive, I mean take the entire airplane apart down to bare metal massive. The control surfaces were gone or destroyed. The flight deck instruments were either missing or corroded into uselessness. The bomb bay was a mess. The pressurization system, which was revolutionary technology in 1944, had to be completely rebuilt. The remote-controlled gun turret system, one of the most complex pieces of engineering on the airplane, had to be sourced from parts scattered across the country.
And the engines, oh the engines. The Wright R3350 duplex cyclone. 18 cylinders arranged in 2 rows. 2200 horsepower each. 4 of them on the wing. These engines were the heart and the headache of the B-29 program during the war. They overheated, they caught fire, they were temperamental on a good day, and finding 4 of them in rebuildable condition in the 21st century was like finding 4 unicorns in a parking lot. The Doc's Friends organization, as the restoration group came to be known, scrounged engines from museums, from private collectors, from old military surplus channels that most people didn't even know existed. Each engine had to be completely torn down, inspected, rebuilt, and tested. Every cylinder, every valve, every pushrod. Thousands of parts per engine, 4 engines, and no margin for error because these things were going to carry people through the sky. The volunteers worked in a hangar at the old Boeing plant in Wichita, and when I say volunteers, I mean it. Retirees, mechanics, engineers. High school kids learning sheet metal work for the first time.
folks who drove hours just to spend a Saturday pulling rivets. At its peak, the project had hundreds of volunteers rotating through. Some gave weekends, some gave years. There's a story I love about one of the older volunteers, a man in his 80s who had worked on the B-29 production line during the war. He'd walk into the hangar, run his hand along the fuselage, and say he could still feel the rhythm of the rivet guns from 1944. He wasn't being sentimental, he was being literal. The muscle memory was still in his hands. The airframe itself required thousands of square feet of new aluminum skin. They couldn't just go to the hardware store. This was aircraft-grade 2024 aluminum, and it had to be formed to match the compound curves of a 1940s bomber. Some of the original tooling still existed at Boeing, and the company helped where they could, but a lot of it was hand-formed. Skilled craftsmen shaping metal over English wheels and planishing hammers, using techniques that haven't changed much since the Wright brothers were bending tin in Dayton.
The wing spar inspections alone took months. The main spar on a B-29 is the structural backbone of the entire wing. It carries the loads of four engines, thousands of gallons of fuel, and the stresses of flight. If that spar has a crack, you don't fly, period. They inspected every inch with dye-penetrant and eddy current testing, and when they found areas that needed work, they repaired them to original Boeing specifications, not approximations. Original specs. Year after year, the airplane slowly came together. New wiring harnesses, new hydraulic lines, new fuel cells. The fuel system alone was a nightmare. The B-29 carried over 9,000 gallons of aviation fuel in self-sealing tanks spread through the wings and fuselage. Every tank had to be either restored or replaced. Every fuel line had to be pressure tested. Every connection had to be perfect because fuel leaks and 2,000-degree exhaust don't mix well. The instrument panel was rebuilt with original gauges sourced from collectors and surplus dealers around the world. Each instrument was calibrated and tested. The autopilot system, one of the first truly effective autopilots ever put in a bomber, was restored to working condition. And the pressurization system, which allowed the B-29 to fly above 25,000 feet in relative comfort while other bombers froze their crews, was brought back to life. Now, I want you to understand the scale of what we're talking about. A B-29 Superfortress is 99 feet long. The wingspan is 141 feet. Empty weight is about 74,500 pounds. That's 37 tons of airplane before you put a single gallon of fuel in it. And every single system on that airplane had to work before the Federal Aviation Administration would sign off on the airworthiness certificate. The FAA involvement was its own odyssey. This wasn't a certified production aircraft anymore. It was a one-off restoration with no type certificate support from the manufacturer. Every modification, every repair, every replacement part had to be documented and approved. The paperwork alone filled cabinets.
And then there were setbacks. Funding dried up more than once. The project had to move locations. Key volunteers got sick or passed away before they could see the airplane fly. There were moments, real moments, when the whole thing almost died, when the money ran out and the hangar was quiet, and the airplane just sat there, waiting. The way she'd waited in the desert for all those years. But somebody always stepped up. A donation would come in. A new volunteer would walk through the door with exactly the right skill set. A parts source would materialize out of nowhere. It was like the airplane refused to quit. In 2016, after nearly two decades of restoration work, Doc was ready for engine runs. Picture this. A summer day in Wichita. The hangar doors are open. Hundreds of volunteers and supporters are standing on the ramp. And one by one, those four Wright Cyclones cough, bark, belch blue smoke, and rumble to life. 1,800 horsepower, then 3,600, then 5,400. Then the full 8,800 horses shaking the ground and rattling windows a quarter mile away. People cried, grown men and women who had spent years covered in grease and aluminum shavings, who had given their weekends and their retirement savings and their backs and their knees to this airplane, stood there and cried. Because the sound of those four radials was the sound of something everyone said was impossible. On July 17, 2016, Doc flew for the first time in 60 years. She lifted off from McConnell Air Force Base in Wichita, the same ground where Boeing had tested her back in 1944, and climbed into a Kansas sky that probably looked exactly the same as it did seven decades earlier. The pilot reported she handled beautifully, responsive, solid, like a brand new airplane. She's been flying ever since. Doc is based in Wichita now, at her own hangar and museum at Eisenhower National Airport. She does air show appearances and heritage flights around the country. She's flown formation with Fifi, giving crowds the extraordinary sight of two flying B-29s together. That's something most aviation historians never expected to see again.
But here's what I think about when I think about Doc. It's not the airplane, really. It's the people. It's Tony Mazzolini,
who looked at a Desert Hulk and saw a flying machine. It's the World War II veterans who came back to the rivet guns one more time. It's the kid who learned to buck rivets on a Saturday morning and is probably an aircraft mechanic somewhere today. It's the donors who sent $20 checks because they couldn't afford more but couldn't stand to do nothing. Aviation restorations are always about more than the metal. They're about refusing to let something important disappear. The B-29 changed the world. You can argue about how, and you can argue about whether all of it was good, but you can't argue that it mattered, and Doc makes sure we remember that. Not in a glass case, not behind a velvet rope. In the sky, where she belongs, with those four cyclones singing the song they were built to sing. That story drew from Doc's friend's own published history, the Wichita Eagle's extensive coverage of the restoration, and several interviews with Tony Mazzolini over the years. More at RadioHangar.com. I'm Taildragger. Go see that airplane if you get the chance. You'll hear those engines in your chest for a week.